All righty. 45% of your final grade are in the books. 55% of your final grade to go. Paper, 20% due April 26th, Friday, through Engage by 11:59 p.m. And your final exam is on Thursday the 9th of May. I will have your exams done hopefully by Wednesday. I was planning on working on them yesterday, but unfortunately I had to be a lawyer. And today I have to be a professor. So tomorrow I have an off day, so I will be in the office and I will sit down and I'll try to bang out everyone's. Hopefully you all took it, because again, at this point it would really stink to get a zero at this point in the game. All right. Any questions on the papers? I've said it before and I'll say it again. Probably say it at the end of class. This class has a tendency to be tardy. All the instructions on the webs are on my website, proflamanic.com. Make sure before you drop it in Engage, you review that page from top to bottom. Because as I said multiple times, this assignment is based on following directions. Good grades come from those who follow directions. Bad grades come from those who don't. So, if there's anything on there that you are unsure of, I actually had two paper questions in my last class. And I was glad that they were raised. But if any of you have any questions about anything, ask. Because chances are there's other people in the class that have similar questions. And just because you are a shy or a scared, it would be kind of silly to lose points just because you're afraid to ask questions. All right, our final exam will not be cumulative. Even though the final exam is worth 35% of your final average, it is not going to be any longer than exams 1, 2, or 3. I make the final the highest percentage of your average because usually it's the final that everyone does the best on. Because it's the most recent information and it's stuff that you probably already know a little bit about. Because, my friends, we are heading full-blown to World War I. For what? One attempt. Yeah, one swing at the ball, as it were.
When you made mention of the average, that's the way I asked whether it was a two attempt or just
one. No, just one attempt. All right, road to World War I. World War I was not inevitable. It was a war that did not have to happen. But what it was a consequence of the age of new imperialism. The world is only so big. And when you had all of the great powers going and carving up every last little chunk of it so they could gain resources, wealth, to fuel their industrial revolutions, it was only a matter of time when they ran out of space. And ultimately, if you have any situation where you have multiple people trying to do one thing, get one item, it frequently results in fisticuffs. One of my favorite examples that I like to give is something that is true to life. It actually happened to me, when I was your age in college. Me and my roommates, a bunch of lunkheads, we ordered pizza, and pizza was delivered. But like all of you, the amount of pizza that we got was not enough to satiate our appetites of growing young men. So we ended up with a situation where there was about six of us, and we were all still hungry, but there was one slice of pizza in the box. Who gets it? What? Who gets it? Exactly. You got to fight for it. And that's what we did. We ended up breaking the table in our common area. And our RA was kind of angry at us. But in the end, I can honestly say I didn't get it. But ultimately, that's what ended up happening. You had the great powers carving out the land. It ended up where there was no land. And so they all began fighting over literally godforsaken places on the earth. Now, to make matters worse, Europe, when World War I erupted, was at its height in terms of confidence. I mean, literally, England, France, the newly unified Germany, the newly unified Italy, Spain, Portugal, the Netherlands, the United States, Russia, and Japan pretty much conquered the whole earth. They felt that they could do anything they wanted. Their economies were booming. Standards of living was on the rise. There was electricity. There was factories. The modern world was coming into creation. And adding to this was the fact that there was a 40-year span, one of the longest spans in European history, where there were no wars in Europe. The last war, which we're going to talk about first, was the Franco-Prussian War, which ended in 1871. So when you get into the 1880s, 1890s, 1900s, even into the 1910s, they believed that war was a thing of the past. That war was extinct. Because tensions were handled diplomatically. They had conferences. They had treaties that were signed and agreements and conventions. And in the end, war was always avoided through negotiations. But with success comes ego. And social Darwinism, which we talked about. Social Darwinism, which glorified war as proof of strength, caused the nations to, at the same time their economies are increasing, to simultaneously increase their military capacity. Artillery got bigger. Guns got more effective and automated. Machine guns came into being. Methods of death were on the rise. So, finite spaces, overconfidence, believing that war could never happen, but an increased belligerency, all it would take is one thing to spark a cataclysm. And hopefully you all know the spark occurred on June 28th, 1940, when one man was killed. All of the tensions exploded because of the death of one, resulting in the death of millions. Questions so far? All right. Well, most historians trace the starting point of the road to World War I with the creation of Germany. Germany, prior to... Sorry, I was just seeing what I have in here and whereabouts I have it, so I don't be redundant. Prior to 1871, did not exist. Germany was not a country. There was the German culture, and most of the people that lived in the central part of Europe were ethnically, culturally Germans. They had similar traditions, they spoke the same language, they made damn good beer. Not that any of you who are under 21 knows what I'm talking about. I'm talking about root beer. Root beer, that's for sure. But they were politically separated into separate states. And as late as the 1860s, Germany was comprised of 26 independent countries. They had their own governments. Most of them had their own monarchs. They had their own legislative branches. They had their own economies. They had their own armies. But there were some people that simply started asking the question, what happens if we take the strength of 26 countries and fuse it together into one? Well, the person who would do that was one of the most gifted political minds of all ages, Otto von Bismarck. All right, let me just check in my friends who are tardy, frequently tardy, so you get your dots. All right. Oh, Ashley's back. Hi.
Hi.
Now, every now and then I like to share a little insight just so you can kind of get to know the kind of weirdo that I am. Back when I was in college, yes, I'll admit it, although I don't think they make them anymore. But back when I was your age, one of the best things that you could put up on your dorm room was, not trying to be offensive, were beer girl posters. Advertisements made by the beer companies with scantily clad women. I'm sure they had men as well, but I wasn't into that. So I did have a couple of posters of the beer girls, I'll admit it. But the one poster my roommates used to bust my chops about was the fact that I had this image as a poster on my dorm room. As a history and political science major, I was fascinated by the ideas and methods of this man, Otto von Bismarck. Because you could make the argument that he is indirectly responsible for the modern world. What he wanted to do was to take the 26 nations, fuse them into a single country, and by effect it would make the most powerful country on the continent. A true game changer. Prior to creating Germany, he served in the large German state of Prussia as their chancellor. They did have a king, but the king was constitutionally limited. So the person responsible for running the state was the chancellor, kind of like a prime minister. He is known as the Iron Chancellor because he didn't worry about people's feelings. He wasn't interested in popularity contests. Instead, he was focused on getting the job done. In terms of politics, he practiced and mastered what is known as realpolitik. To make it simple, realpolitik is the policy of realism. It involves making pragmatic decisions to achieve goals. There's no ideology. There's no left versus right. There's no morality. There's no ethics. It's about accomplishing your aims. Doing anything to achieve those goals. Even instigating wars. FYI, in 1864, he instigated a war with Denmark by tricking Prussia's ally of Austria into declaring war. And in the course of the war, Prussia ended up getting the best deal. Play the game. And then just 2 years later, he instigated a war with Austria. Of course, he got them to declare war so he could sit back and be the victim. But in doing so, he was able to drive Austria out of what would become Germany, even though the Austrians were German as well. In terms of domestic policy, he eroded support for what today we would call progressives, liberals, socialists, by at the same time giving the people in Prussia the very things that the socialists were calling for: public education, regulated health care, insurance, government insurance, like we give Social Security for handicapped individuals. So whatever the progressives are calling for, he managed to give it to them. And he flipped it by basically claiming it was his idea. But he was doing so in the name of the king. So the people who might have become socialists hated the socialists and loved the monarch. He also used nationalism, because he understood that most people like being parts of groups. And one of the threats to the groups are the people on the outside. So he talked about how great Prussia was, but at the same time he kept calling for unification with all the other German states so Germany could be bigger and stronger. It was said that Bismarck was capable of playing chess in three dimensions. He wasn't just one move ahead of his opponent. He was 6, 8, 10 moves ahead. And he wasn't afraid to engage in trickery. He would make you believe he was going down the left route, only to somehow achieve his route from the right, or vice versa. Misdirection, I guess, is the best you could say. But here's the amazing thing. If you go have the ability to ever read some of the translated newspapers that were printed in Germany during his time, his moves were always questioned as being illogical. It makes no sense. But at the end, Bismarck always achieved his goal. And what it was taking the Prussian system and superimposing it on all of Germany. Prussia was a monarchy that had a strong nobility and embraced militarism. Monarchy, nobility, militarism. So what he wanted to do was to take all the different German states and fuse it around a Prussian core. So that way the king of Prussia could be the emperor. And that the nobles of Prussia could be the ruling class for Germany. And of course, the Prussian military system would be the system that would cause Germany to be a power. To achieve those, he constantly circumvented the Constitution by manipulating the loopholes that sit in every legal code. This became known as the gap theory. FYI, under the Prussian Constitution, the king essentially was similar to the old Roman dictator. In other words, if an emergency arose, the king could take whatever measures necessary to protect the state. And that's all that the justification had to be. I'm doing this for the good of the state. But again, it was a constitutional monarchy. There was a legislative branch, a parliament. And that parliament under the Constitution was in charge of money, taxing and spending. So, in order to get the funding he wanted, say, for the military, he would constantly present a budget that would be rejected by the parliament. And thus, like you hear on the news if you pay attention, every now and then, like, the government's engaged on the brink of bankruptcy and shutting down because, you know, they haven't passed a spending budget. Well, in our system, if the government doesn't get funded, everyone gets furloughed. Certain sectors of the government stop. Well, in the Prussian system, if a budget doesn't get passed, that could be declared a national emergency, and the king would have the power to take whatever money is in the treasury and spend it as he wanted. So, when the Prussian assembly wanted to spend things on, like, better schools, government hospitals, he would allow them to collect the tax money, then he would stall the budget, cause a crisis, and then take the money and redirect it towards the army. Long-winded and complicated, but it was a brilliant system. Because if you really look at it from the big picture sense, basically the crown is ruling like a dictator. He's able to do whatever he wants within the confines of a constitutional monarchy. And the end game was always the same. A unified German state surrounded a Prussian core. Prior to Germany, Central Europe was dominated for about 1,000 years by a system called the Holy Roman Empire. That was the system that Charles V controlled. Now, we didn't really talk about Charles V in this class. All right, but anyways, the Holy Roman Empire. That system was in place until Napoleon destroyed it in 1815. The Germans then replaced that by a loose-knit confederation in which all of the German states agreed to basically not engage in economic warfare against one another. So they made free trade. Germany became a free trade zone. But there were two powers in it, Austria and Prussia. So as I said, Bismarck wanted to control it, so he instigated two wars and eventually got Austria out. But that still left a division between the northern 22 states who were mostly Protestant and the southern 4 states who were mostly Catholic. Now, while it had been it was the 30 Years' War, which came to an end in the 1640s. So it had been about 200 years since Catholics fought Protestants. But the Catholics didn't like Bismarck because Bismarck was an overt Lutheran. So in order for him to achieve his goal, he had to bring in those 4 Catholic states. So what's the one measure that's more powerful than religion? Nationalism. All the way up through American history, all the way up until like the 1960s, 1970s. It was okay during the 1980s, but then it devolved again in the 1990s, and it's only been spiraling out of control since. In that you have powerful political forces in our country that are constantly trying to divide us based on things like race, religion, gender, yada, yada, yada. But prior to the 1960s, if you really dig down in American history, for the most part, those divisions were not present. Everyone was kind of on the same same page. Everyone was, generally speaking, ooh-rah American. Yeah, we did have some issues. I'm not saying we were perfect. But there was little difference in opinion and love of this country amongst the political parties, the different classes, the different religions. If you were in America, you were here because you loved America and you wanted to be American. Sadly, today we have many people that want to destroy America, not understanding that it doesn't get any better anywhere else on Earth. But whatever. Bismarck, however, realized that you can use nationalism if you can focus on the one thing that all the people have in common, you can build a large movement. And that's what he decided to do. Because while some Germans were Catholic and didn't like his Lutheranism, he realized the only thing that the German Catholics hated more than German Lutherans were the French. So, to unify Germany, Bismarck would instigate the biggest of the three wars which he was responsible for, the Franco-Prussian War. Because Bismarck would essentially force those southern Catholic German states to decide, whose side are you on? Are you German or are you friends with the French? Now, FYI, most of you probably don't know that up until World War I, the arch villain of Europe was not Germany, but rather it was France. France, going back to the time of Charlemagne, was responsible for almost every single major continental war. They were the arch villains. And in the 200 years prior to the Franco-Prussian War, France had declared war on Germany, portions of Germany, over 30 times. So, France was long regarded as the greatest threat to Europe. Heck, think of Napoleon, if you studied Napoleon. All of the European countries, Russia, Austria, Prussia, England, Spain, they all made a grand alliance to fight against Napoleon. Same thing was true during the reigns of the Louis. So, this was easy for Bismarck. Because everybody hated the French. So what he would do to get this war was play upon the nationalist heartstrings of both the people of France and Germany. FYI, no background. In the years prior to the outbreak of the war, there was a vacancy on the Spanish throne. The Queen of Spain was removed in a revolution of sorts, and the people of Spain wanted a new monarch. They sent an offer to a German prince who happened to be a distant cousin of the King of Prussia. The people of Spain were okay with having a German king. But when France found out about it, they were outraged. Because the ruler of France at the time, Napoleon III, did not want to have a German prince to his south and a German state to his east. So he sent his ambassador to go meet with the King of Prussia. This telegram was a report that was sent to Bismarck by one of his aides who observed the meeting. Now, FYI, in a true factual sense, the ambassador met with the king and simply asked him to convince his cousin not to become the king of Spain, because the French would be appreciative if he did so. But the Kaiser responded politely, "It's not my call. I'm the king of Prussia. I'm not the king of Spain. If the Spanish people want him, it's up to them." Both men shook hands, used the correct protocol, and went their own ways. But Bismarck saw this as an opportunity. So he took the telegram, the report, and tweaked it and created two versions. In one version, the king was rude and insulting to the French ambassador and basically mocked the French people. In another version, the French ambassador was rude to the king of Prussia and was insulting to him and mocked the German people. He then took the doctored versions and sent the one that made the Germans look bad to the French newspapers secretly, anonymously. And then he leaked the ones that made the French look bad in the eyes of the Germans to the German newspapers. We shall call that, to use modern phraseology, misinformation. Which, by the way, almost anything you get on TikTok, social media, or even the cable news channels is all misinformation. They never tell the truth. It's all spin. And what ended up happening? Well, just like Bismarck predicted, the people in France were outraged. They felt their national honor was besmirched, and they wanted justice, as did the people of Germany. The problem is, the Emperor of France, Napoleon III, who was not an absolute monarch and was kind of like a popularly elected king, bent the knee to the mob. And he declared war on Prussia. Now, FYI, behind the scenes, the reason why Napoleon did so was he had made a secret agreement with Austria that Austria would also attack Prussia in revenge for the previous war. But unbeknownst to Napoleon, Bismarck's spies discovered it. So Bismarck had made a secret agreement with Russia, in which Russia would attack Austria if Austria attacked Germany. And then he leaked it to the Austrians. So they knew if they dared attack Prussia, the Russians are going to invade their country. So the Austrians bowed out. Three-dimensional chess. So in the end, France had to go it alone. France went to war effectively against an alliance of 26 countries. Nobody else came in to help France. I think it's going to go to the next screen, but I'm not sure. Questions? Or flips? I guess it doesn't. All right. Now, in terms of modern wars, the Franco-Prussian Wars is one of the most lopsided wars of recent years. It wasn't even a contest. And the reason why it wasn't a contest is because of what the Prussians deployed. They had sent military observers. They went and visited the Crimean War. They went and visited the U.S. Civil War. And they bought the most modern pieces of military tech available. Mass produced them and adopted them. One of the most important weapons that the German soldiers had was a breech-loading rifle. A breech-loading rifle is a rifle that you can open a top door and put a round in and close it. The French were still using muzzle loaders. In order to load a muzzle loader, you have to stand up. Whereas if you're using a breech-loading rifle, you can get down, you can lie on the ground if you want to. Just get open a little door and put the bullet in. You can sit down behind rocks and walls and other protections. Whereas if you're using a muzzleloader, you're standing up. And guess what's going to happen to a soldier who's standing up in brightly colored uniforms? His head is going to go... The Prussians also fired artillery that had percussion caps. So it wasn't just a solid bomb, solid piece of iron that came flying over. It was a big bullet-shaped device that when it hit the ground, it blew up, it detonated from the force of the impact. So instead of shooting solid projectiles, they had the capacity to blow up French positions. They also used telegraph wires. They literally had specially trained soldiers that had big backpacks on them, that had cable wheels on it. And wherever the Prussian units went, they dropped the telegraph lines that allowed the Germans to be in constant communication with their soldiers. The French still used either horseback carriers or couriers that were on foot. And the Germans figured out how the Union won the Civil War. The Confederate soldiers, man to man, were superior fighters. If you look at the Civil War, the Confederacy actually won most of the battles. But the Union was able to win because they controlled the railroads. So they could send in men by train. They could send in food. They could send in munitions. There weren't many miles of railroad in France. So whereas the German soldiers could be transported to the battlefield, the French soldiers had to walk. And have any of you walked for 100 miles nonstop? I did. Last summer, did a charity walk. Walked from Sutton all the way to North Adams. Actually, it was 120 miles. Needless to say, when I got there, I was tired. Raised a lot of money, but I was still tired. So, using technology, the Prussians were able to completely overwhelm the French. August 2nd is when the first shots were fired. August 2nd, 1870. But by September 2nd, Napoleon himself was captured, leading the French First Army. And while prisoner, he was forced to abdicate, which suddenly means the French have no government. By October 29th, both the 2nd and the 3rd French armies were destroyed. They surrendered. And France was occupied. The only place that held out was Paris. But Paris itself was surrounded. They cut off food, they cut off water. And by January 28th, Paris surrendered. And to stick it in the eyes of the French, on the anniversary of the foundation of the Kingdom of Prussia, January 18th, the Kaiser, or the King of Prussia, along with government representatives of the 26 German states, went to the palace of Louis XIV, Versailles, stood in the Hall of Mirrors, And they all proclaimed the King of Prussia, Wilhelm I, to be Kaiser. The German word for Caesar, which throughout European history was always regarded as the name that you gave to the emperor. Then, once Germany was unified, they imposed a humiliating treaty upon the Germans, the Treaty of Frankfurt. In this treaty, France was forced to pay Germany 5 billion francs. And they were forced to give up land. Money and land. But the land that they took was significant. Now, FYI, the Alsace and Lorraine region, this is Lorraine, this is Alsace, right there. These provinces were originally part of Germany. Even as late as 1871, the majority of the people in these provinces, even though they were part of France, considered themselves to be culturally German. They had been taken by Louis XIV in one of the many wars that took place. But Bismarck was not taking them because of their historic or their sentimental value. That's not Bismarck. Realpolitik. 70% of France's coal and 50% of their iron came from Alsace and Lorraine. Bismarck took Alsace and Lorraine to cripple the French economy so that way they couldn't fight back and seek revenge. Questions? All right. So now, thanks to unification, in literally a stroke of a pen, the most powerful state on the continent is created. And no matter what metric you use, the only other European power that was more powerful than Germany was England. And that was because England controlled 1/8 of the earth. But in terms of on the continent, they had the strongest economy. They had the strongest industrial sector. They had the largest population. They had the most farmland in terms of production. You name it, whatever metric. They had the most educated people. They had the leading scientists, the leading engineers. They were the greatest in everything. Kind of like how we became. And for the German nationalists, this was proof positive of the superiority. Think of social Darwinism. What more proof than you want that you are superior than anyone else, than you win wars? And you achieve your goals. But 1871 was the dawn of new imperialism. So many of these German nationalists suddenly began saying, we're so great, maybe we should go global. Maybe we should begin flexing our muscles around the globe, going into Africa, going into Asia, just like England and France. And nationalism began to grow extreme. There were many leading German intellectuals that literally used the language of social Darwinism. Even though Germany had become all powerful, all strong, they began saying essentially that they were in a struggle for survival. that the only way to keep the German people safe is to continue to grow. Because if you don't grow, you're going to die. While Germany had always been a land-based region, these nationalists began saying Germany should create a navy. And Germany should go start seizing colonies. And building a stronger economy by tapping world markets. Drunk with success. But guess who wasn't? Bismarck. Realpolitik. Any of you ever build models? Model cars, model planes? When you put it together, can you play with it right away? Why not?
The glue has to dry.
The glue has to dry. So to all of those nationalists that said, oh, look, we're Germany, now let's go global, Bismarck basically said, are we really Germany? We are Germans, but all we have is a piece of paper that says we are Germany. But the people, when you went throughout Germany, they didn't consider themselves members of Germany. They still considered themselves as Prussians or Bavarians or Saxons. They identified with their local state, not the country. So Bismarck was fearful that if Germany jumped into global competition, a global war could erupt and Germany could be pulled apart. So, he would engage in twofold path to preserve unification. Domestically, he would crush anybody who went against his policies. Liberals, conservatives, socialists, libertarians, didn't matter. And in terms of foreign policy, no more war. He used three wars to get what he wanted, but then suddenly he stopped. Instead, he would focus on diplomacy. Oh, I guess I do go into more detail. All right. In terms of domestic policy, like I said, he wanted to take the Prussian system and supplant that, superimpose that over all the German states. And again, we're not going to get into the specifics, but he would manipulate politics using realpolitik strategies and his gap theory. And he would use the ideas of any political group to get what he wanted. So, he would use the liberals to get a national currency. He would use the liberals to get a central bank. He would use the liberals to get funding for railroad expansion, a postal system. But he would also use the Catholics to get tariffs put in place to protect German industry. I already told you, he checked the socialists by creating the welfare state. Whenever he could, he would stall legislation. And he would use the gap theory to manipulate the situation to accomplish his goals. On terms of foreign policy, he wasn't MAGA. He wasn't trying to make America great again. He was trying to make the German Empire great again. So, making Germany great again. Mugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugugug
Just rolls off the tongue.
So how would he do it? Well, he would basically tell the world, we're not taking any more territory. We've unified the German lands, and that's all we want. We're not going to encroach anywhere on earth. We're not going to interfere. If England wants to conquer and maintain control over all of India, they can do that. If they want to use the opium wars to impose uneven, equal treaties on China, they can do that. If they want to use political manipulation to take control of the Suez Canal and dominate Egypt, they can do that. Germany is not going to interfere. It's none of their business. And to make sure there never would be wars that threaten Germany, he engaged the European powers in diplomacy. He didn't use threatening or hostile language. He was always respectful. But he was using these techniques, three-dimensional chess. Because Bismarck looked at the map of Europe and he realized there's really only two situations that could threaten Germany. There's only two things that could cause our model to break apart before the glue sets. One would be a war with France. Because here is the Deutsches Kaiserreich, the German Empire, right here. And there's France. Belgium, tiny, neutral power. Netherlands, tiny, not really a power. Switzerland, always neutral. But then there's France, right on the western border. France, which is angry because we took Alsace and Lorraine. France, who's humiliated, how easily we kicked the living snot out of their armies. France, who wants revenge. But France, he knew, was a bunch of cowards, and France would never attack alone because Germany is stronger. So, he would focus on making sure France had no friends. At the same time, he didn't want a war between, essentially, the two empires that encompassed his entire eastern border. Russia, which at the time not only had the Ukraine, go back. Not only had the Ukraine, but also had Poland as part of its empire. And the Austrian Empire, which once it got kicked out of Germany, focused on looking down at the Balkans. Going back decades, the Austrians and the Russians hated one another. But the southern German states were sympathetic to Austria, and many of the northern German states were sympathetic to Russia. So if these two countries went to war, Germany literally could be ripped in two. So, not only do we want to keep France on its own, but we want to make sure Austria and Russia never go to war. The game moves from three-dimensional chess to Twister. In comes Bismarck's most amazing accomplishment. What today is regarded as his alliance system. Now, throughout most of history, alliances were used to prevent war by putting together strength to intimidate adversaries. Bismarck's alliance system was essentially the same. These systems were not created to start a war, but to prevent war by holding the hands of everybody. Again, like Twister, trying to put your hands on every single dot. Question. The first alliance system, which was really informal, would be established when Bismarck convinced the emperors of the German, the Austrian, and the Russian empires to meet. And they would create what became known as the Three Emperors League. You have Kaiser Wilhelm I, the Emperor of Germany. You have Franz Joseph of Austria. And you have Tsar Alexander I. Each one had their own natural national interests at stake, but they all had two things in common. And this is what Bismarck focused on. Again, you don't focus on what divides people. You focus on what they have in common. One, all of the emperors despised Marxism. Karl Marx wrote Das Kapital in the 1840s. And by the 1860s, 1870s, many radical revolutionaries embraced Marxist theory and were attempting to start pseudo-Marxist revolutions using violence, assassination, terrorism to achieve their goals. All of these three men had failed assassination attempts against their lives. So each of them definitely were interested in combining forces to crush any Marxist revolutionary group that could be a threat to their states. Interestingly enough, they also didn't want a large-scale war. They wanted to maintain, through a balance of power, peace. Because despite what some people would have you believe, that war is good for business, at the end of the day, it may be good for business, but it's not good for countries. Because even winners of wars lose. They lose blood, and they lose treasure. So these three guys didn't want big wars started. Things were great for 5 years until a war erupted and the friendship broke apart. If you will recall, we talked about this when we were talking about the collapse of the Ottoman Empire. In 1877, Russo-Turkish War erupted. But as I have here, I just want to recognize this is the 11th time that Russia and Austria fight a war. I mean, Russia and the Ottoman Empire had fought a war. At one part, the Ottomans controlled not only the Crimean region, but controlled almost the entire Caucasus as well. The Black Sea was practically an Ottoman lake. But going back to Tsar Peter the Great, Russians fought wars and were slowly driving the Ottomans away. This war, if you recall, began not with Russia, but it began when the Baltic states attempted to break away and declare their independence. Bulgaria, Serbia, Montenegro, and Romania. They were Christian states that were tired of living under the yoke of the Muslim Ottoman Empire. So when this war erupted, Russia would attempt to bring them together in kind of a coalition. The Russians enjoyed the idea of these states becoming independent because that meant the Ottoman Empire is becoming weaker. But the Russians also wanted That point right there, and that point right down there. Commonly referred to as the Bosporus, the Dardanelles, or simply the Turkish Straits. Russia, because it now had ports and bases on the North Sea, wanted to use these warm water ports as the launching pad into the global economy. But the Ottomans would not give them access. So the Russians hoped to use this war for independence as a smokescreen for them to finally break out of the Black Sea. We covered this. I don't know if I necessarily covered this. No, I think I did. Kind of in passing. Well, the problem is, in terms of balance of power, if you remember, I said at this time, the European powers were propping up the Ottoman Empire. Because all of them had money invested. The Ottoman government owed debts, tens of millions and billions of dollars. They knew they would never get paid if the Ottoman Empire went bankrupt, belly up, and broke apart. So the moment Russia gets in, that's a huge international crisis because Russia has the capacity to destroy the Ottoman Empire. Plus, if Russia gets access to the Mediterranean, suddenly you have another competitor in terms of the global economic competition. So, when the war erupted, England and Austria voiced their concerns, as well as the French. But in the end, the war was quick. The Ottomans sued for peace. They then negotiated a settlement. Treaty of San Stefano. Because the Russians were on the winning side, the Russians pretty much got what they wanted. The Slavic states would be freed, made independent countries. Romania, Serbia, Montenegro. Bulgaria would become a sovereign power, so their own government would control their own lands, but they would stay in the empire and they would serve as a buffer state. Bulgaria would be allied to Russia in order to protect them from Ottoman punishment. And, most importantly, the Ottomans would give the Russians the right to travel out the straits. I'm not going to ask you on the exam. We've already covered those details. But like I said, this is a threat to the balance of power. If the Ottomans get weaker, they can't pay their bills. If the Russian ships are going into the global exchange, then they're going to be able to flood the market with cheap wheat and other agricultural products and start making money and possibly industrialize. So Austria was terrified about these new independent Slavic states. And England was terrified at the global competition. So, both the British and the Austrians began protesting loudly. And they began demanding another conference to deal with the issues. And notice where it was held. Guess who would sit and serve as arbitrator? Bismarck. Bismarck. The Congress moved against Russia's plans. They basically denied Russia's rights under international law. Bulgaria was not given domestic sovereignty. It was shrunk in size. Russia was denied access to the Turkish Straits. Yes. Serbia, Romania, Montenegro, they were given their independence. But, for some reason, Bosnia and Herzegovina, Austria, got the right to oversee. So, Britain got something that it wanted. Austria got something that it wanted. But the country who fought the war and won, Russia, got screwed. In the end, Tsar Alexander was disgusted, infuriated, and he publicly announced that the Three Emperors League was dead. So the first attempt at getting the guys to hold their hands went poof. Questions? But now, just 6 years after, 7 years after the end of the Franco-Prussian War, the glue is not dried. There are now two looming threats to Bismarck's peace. Two potential tinderboxes that could ignite and trigger a war which could rip Germany apart. The first is this situation with Bosnia and Herzegovina. This land that somehow Austria now has control over. Lands that do not have Austrians that live there, but rather ethnic Slavic peoples, the Bosnians and the Herzegovinians. They are ethnic cousins with the people of the Balkan Peninsula. Most significantly, in a historical sense, these lands were once part of a kingdom of Serbia that had existed back in the 13th and the 14th centuries, back before they were conquered by the Ottomans. The newly independent Serbs were livid. They said, these are our lands. These are our people. Why are the German Austrians controlling them? They demanded justice. And at the same time, the Russians were pissed. And they felt betrayed by Bismarck, who served as mediator for the Berlin Conference. So, we have two potential threats that could trigger a war. In comes Realpolitik. Let's analyze the situation. As far as the Balkan goes, Bismarck decides that even if a war erupts between Austria and Serbia, Germany is not going to be impacted. Nobody likes the Serbs. So their chances are no Germans that are going to want to go to the aid of the Serbians. But rather, the majority of the Germans would support the Austrians. So we can check that box. But Russia, that's a bigger problem. So let's see if we can check them. And how do we prevent a war? Well, we'll make an alliance. In 1879, Germany and the Austro-Hungarian Empire would sign a secret treaty. The sole purpose of this treaty was Realpolitik. even though the majority of the Germans, the northern Germans, would rather side with the Russians over the Austrians, Bismarck knew if the Russians learned that Austria had a treaty with Germany, Russia would come crawling back. So, he would create what would become known as the Dual Alliance. And by the way, the terms were originally secret, but of course Bismarck leaked them. So that way they ended up in St. Petersburg. This was a purely defensive treaty. And this would become the foundation upon which all of the treaties that we're going to cover were based upon. If Austria or Germany, let's get a marker that works. If Austria or Germany attacked by Russia, specifically named in the treaty, then ally would help. So if Russia attacks Austria, Germany's going to declare war. If Russia attacks Germany, Austria's going to declare war. But any other, then they can declare neutrality. So if Italy attacked Austria, Germany could sit back and say, not my problem. Or if Austria went to war with Serbia, not my problem. The focus was only on Russia. Now here's the thing. Bismarck specifically told the Austrians that if you go to war in the Balkans, you're on your own. And he also told the Austrians, off the record, that if Austria ever attacked Russia, this treaty doesn't apply. This is only a defensive treaty. Germany only goes to war if Russia attacks Austria. But if Austria attacks, Germany's not getting involved. So do you think Austria in their right mind would ever attack Russia on their own? No. And here's the final piece, which is most delicious. Oh, I'm going to save it because I see we're out of time. All right, I got one more little element to add, but we'll show you how Bismarck kind of leaked things out. We're going to come back on Thursday. We're going to finish this. We're going to talk about the Austro-Hungarian Empire, what that country was all about. We're going to see how Russia would come back in, and we're going to continue looking at Bismarck's real politics. Papers are due for those of you who came late, which is most of the class. Remember, we start at 12:15, please. Papers are due April 26th. Make sure you go to proflamanic.com. Before you drop them in Engage, if there's any questions, bring them to class. 20% of your grade will come from that paper.
You said you're grading the exams tomorrow.
Yes, that's my goal.